The views and opinions expressed on the following program are not necessarily those of the staff and management of KLAY or those who advertise their products or services on this station.
Welcome, welcome once again. This is Ask an Atheist, a weekly educational call-in program about atheism and topics relating to atheism. My name is Sam Mulvey. I'm your host today, and with me are Case. Hey.
Hello, everybody.
And Jeremy Whitman. How you doing?
Oh, pretty good.
It's been a heck of a week. Once again, this is a call-in program, so if you'd like to talk to us, our phone number is 253-584-1480. I'm being local. I don't always do the area code, but we don't get a lot of local calls, so...
So if you'd like to change that, go ahead and call in.
Absolutely. Come on, Tacoma. We know there's a few of you out there listening.
You know, when you hear that disclaimer and then you hear the bells, you know it's time for Ask an Atheist.
And you know what's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to dive right in. We got an email, and we will do one email today. And this comes from Andrew, who I believe is, who is from Australia. And he says, "Hi, guys. I'm from Australia. I'm 22, and I'm a butcher. I wonder all the time, what right do I have to take other animals' lives for my food, or do I have any? I know it's easy for Christians because they just say they were put here for me to eat, and then I can eat them. But I can't say that. Thanks, guys." It's an interesting one.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a really good one.
And strangely enough, it's not a vegetarian using it as an entry point to make a weird argument for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, Spock said quite wisely, we all feed on death, even vegetarians.
And wow.
Yes. I think that's a great way to start the answer for this, is that we, all of us, every single one of us, feed on death in some way, shape, or form. So there's just, short of becoming a fruitarian, which is nearly impossible.
Right.
It's just one of those things I'm of the opinion you simply have to accept.
A what-tarian?
A fruitarian.
A fruitarian.
That's someone who is a notch above vegetarian or vegan, actually. And they feel that you can only eat things that have fallen on the ground, like pears or apples, bananas or something like that.
What if you live in Detroit? Could you eat a person from a drive-by?
Whoa. You know,
okay.
I'd have to pull up. We'd have to contact the fruitarians directly, but I doubt it.
Yeah, does that go to like felled meat, like cows who died of natural causes? How far does that extend? Actually, fruitarianism, I don't really know.
No? Okay. Yeah, I as far as I know, because it's an offshoot of veganism, it only applies to fruit.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's a tough way to live.
And this is completely unrelated to the weird religious movement, breatharianism?
Breatharian, yes. Yeah. Which is still of doubt. But, and those of you who don't know, breatharians are folks who claim that they can subsist solely through air.
Well, the point here is that when you talk about spirituality or the lack thereof, because we're human beings, food enters into it. And we probably should actually address the question, what can you say? And you referenced Star Trek, so there's a geek reference number one for today.
Yes. Those of you drinking at home.
For those of us who aren't Star Trek fans, there really aren't any easy answers to this one. And Mike and I kick this one around a lot. We grew up, I mean, from an evolutionary standpoint, we didn't get our higher brain functions until we started consuming flesh. And that's just, the evidence is there. And if you're an atheist and you look at the evidence, it's when we started eating meat was when we started thinking. And that's not really a reason, but it is sort of, it is the way things work. Our systems are geared towards eating it. The animals that we generally eat would not exist were it not for our industries to generate the meat. Say what you will about how those processes happen themselves.
Yep.
But what we don't have, and this comes back to the personal responsibility about atheism that I like, is we don't have a pat answer. We have nothing based on faith. We actually have to think about it and come to some sort of conclusion ourselves about whether or not we're going to eat meat. I made that decision a long time ago, and I think meat's tasty.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a moral reason at all.
No, it's not.
It doesn't, but yeah, it's delicious.
for me, on a moral, to answer the moral part of the question, I feel as long as the animals have been treated humanely, and that they've been killed humanely, I'm okay with it. I don't want to see creatures suffer as a result of me eating a hamburger. I mean, within reason. I mean, obviously they have to die at some point in the process, but
right.
But
there are certain farming practices that I cannot morally justify.
Yeah, they're unconscionable. Yeah, like right. Like the way chickens are treated, for example, they pretty much have a foot by foot spot to stand in for
something like that. Yeah. You do have to be careful. I mean, I am sort of I do like to cook and I do like to watch it. And if you're making the decision to buy food morally, don't just read what's on the label, I guess. And that's true for any sort of food. And that's true for anything. Don't just read what's on the label, which is sort of our topic for today. I don't know if the show's title is 30,000 Feet of Skepticism. And for those of you who are familiar with the Ask an Atheist television program, Case here is our skepticism guy.
Yes.
And our pseudoscience guy. You've done a number of shows for us, one about 9/11 truthers, another one about ghost hunting, which was a lot of fun. I was with you on that.
Yes.
And so today, for the new format, we're sort of starting on skepticism, but starting from 30,000 feet in the air. Thus,
right. Yeah, for some of you, this may be just your rough introduction to skepticism, what it is. I mean, like atheism, there are some misconceptions about what skepticism is. Is it just cynical? Is it curmudgeon-y? Is it just closed-mindedness? Is it, the whole notion of making up your opinion about something without thinking it through? And skepticism is none of those. In a nutshell, skepticism is kind of this honest search for knowledge. It's an approach to claims with using the scientific method. It's a positive and powerful methodology that's used to evaluate claims and make decisions.
Right.
Some great examples of skepticism. We'll talk about those in a minute. But we try to avoid logical fallacies, and we try to be logical and reasonable in our thinking. And
sure.
Yeah.
Well, as sort of an introduction to skepticism and stuff, and skepticism and pseudoscience is something that really extends beyond atheism, and is actually in the media today. I mean, it's stuff you open up the headlines, and the stuff that we were discussing here is there. For example.
What's that? Well, what are we talking about now is the
is the news story.
Yes, I think we're looking for a volunteer to read the
All right, so we do have a news story to sort of lead us into this, and this comes to us from the Washington Post.
It's a good one.
And this is a real good one, and this is a perfect example about pseudoscience and why we have to pay attention to it. And it's Wakefield tried to capitalize on the autism vaccine link, report says. Andrew Wakefield, the British doctor who made the now widely discredited claims about a link between autism and childhood vaccines, explored business arrangements to capitalize on the supposed association, according to a new report. In a follow-up to another report published last week in the British medical journal BMJ, investigative reporter Brian Deer describes that documents he obtained under the Freedom of Information Act show that Wakefield met with officials at the Royal Free Medical School in London, where he worked and others to discuss developing new vaccines to replace MMR and other products. So what we're looking at here is someone was tried to get a paper published and got it published by means that were other than on the level, and then he attempted to capitalize upon those means while the study was in the process of being published. Because that's what I'm walking away with.
Right. Here. Yeah. He actually got it published in the Lancet, but the method that he used, he doctored data. He was very selective about what data he used, and then when other researchers tried to reproduce his findings, nobody could.
Right.
Yeah, and so the researcher Brian Deer, I mean, he's been dogging Andrew Wakefield for years for information, for interviews, contacting people that Andrew Wakefield has worked with, and they had a great show on 2020 about how Brian Deer has been chasing this guy down for years now. So it's nice to see all this work come to a fruition where he's able to come to some conclusions about him trying to capitalize financially on this whole autism vaccine link.
But he's kind of opened already Pandora's box at this point with all these studies going out, and people who have been emotionally exploited by these studies are now also all over the news. Like, what's Jenny McCarthy is a big anti-vaxxer.
Yeah, the worst thing that could have happened to this is when a celebrity picked it up and ran with it. Actually, the worst thing that could have happened to the whole story. Yeah.
It became a cause celeb.
Yes.
Almost exactly.
Yeah.
And when things become a cause celeb, science or no science, this is going to continue to be a thing that happens in the media. We're going to be hearing about the dangers of vaccines 300 years from now. It's going to go on forever. I mean, one of our the favorite comments that we like to talk about is
Gear up there on YouTube. It's a huge anti-vaxxer.
Yeah. And then there's Alex Jones.
And Alex Jones also. Yeah.
Who said outright what was
my favorite quote was actually from Gear up, who said these vaccines are full of nothing but cancer and AIDS. Which is interesting to me, because where do you get a vat of cancer?
Yeah,
that's a bit scary.
And how come no one's mentioned the big labeled vat of cancer going into the flu shots?
I think there'd be some documentation on a vat of that stuff.
Yeah.
And once again, this is a claim that has no scientific basis. And in order to judge that, I mean, you have to see where it's coming from, what they have to back it up. And that's what we're talking about today.
Yeah. One of the first rules of skepticism is also don't get your science from Playboy Playmates. Number one.
There's a lot of things you can get from them, but science, not among them. Yes.
I don't think it was even listed in her likes and dislikes on Playboy. It was not peer-reviewed research evaluation.
It'd be a dislike now, I think.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, it's important to know as we have this conversation, there's a complete segment of the population that we're never going to reach. Mm-hmm. And that segment is that science doesn't know everything and that this could be a possibility. Therefore, you don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
And that's a common thread that we're going to see in some of the topics we hit on today is yes, science doesn't know everything, but we have a theory and it's good enough for us. And that's the common thread we're going to see as we work our way through the show today.
We should give a quick shout out to Austin right now and say that we probably misappropriated the word theory there.
How's that?
Hypothesis. Yes.
Well, I was about to get into that is we could do a series of shows just on the misappropriation, quote unquote, of the word theory. Is it when a scientist uses the word theory, they mean something different than what we mean when we say in every.
Exactly. It's different from common usage. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Wildly different from what a Playboy Playmate might think.
But and the thing is we can say that we shouldn't use theory like that, but we have to cope with the fact that if you look in a dictionary and you look up hypothesis, it usually includes the word theory and not in the way that hypothesis leads to theory. And it's part of the language. And if we're being linguistic, it's the descriptivist versus proscriptivist approach, is that if we're describing language as it exists out there, theory and hypothesis are essentially the same thing. But in scientific parlance, it's different.
Right. So I guess for the purposes of the show, we should try to stick to hypothesis in the scientific sense.
I'm with you there.
Just for some measure of consistency.
It is something we do during the show is we try not to use the word theory unless we mean the theory.
Yes, yes.
And when we slip up, we usually spend a couple minutes talking about it. Like
which
we
is what we
now.
Just did, yes.
And just look this stuff up online. There's a dictionary or a scientific book. Textbook.
Right. So,
science doesn't know everything? Was that what we were saying?
Well, you know, there's this whole notion of there's a segment of population that holds this to be true, that science doesn't know everything.
Which is true.
Therefore, my particular favorite hypothesis, be it the autism vaccine link, or whether or not psychics are real, or whether or not ghost hunters are finding ghosts, mm-hmm. even though traditional science as we know it hasn't proven or disproven these things, they hold that their favorite hypothesis holds true.
Okay.
Yeah.
That seems a little convenient.
Yeah. Well, it's a shortcut. It's just a shortcut. And you know,
it's a shortcut to a completely different destination, actually.
Yes.
Because there's no rigorous investigation. There's no standard of truth that they're fighting for there.
Right. And I suppose we should talk about why we're talking about skepticism and pseudoscience on a show that is ostensibly about atheism. Is there is a huge correlation between the two.
At least we like to think so. I mean, a correlation between skepticism and atheism?
There is.
Well, you know, strictly speaking, and you've discussed this on the show before, is atheism is very simply defined as no belief in God.
Right.
And whereas skepticism is a means at looking at claims. And so you could, by using skepticism, come to the conclusion that God does not exist.
Mm-hmm.
Not all skeptics do.
That's true.
Not all skeptics do. There are plenty of skeptics who still hold on to a faith in God or gods.
And it's a Venn diagram that isn't completely a circle. There are atheists who are not skeptics.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've met a few in the course of the show. And
so there are atheists who are complete wackaloons.
There are.
Yes, there are. Yeah, yeah.
And there are some skeptics, as you say, who are not atheists. However, as I said, I think it was last episode when talking to our caller, Nick, is that one of the biggest tools in the atheism toolbox is skepticism, is that as an atheist, we are, you know, we say that there's not complete overlap. But when we start up talking about matters of faith, it is we are skeptics. We are skeptical about the claims of religion, but we are not only skeptical about the claims of religion, especially here on the show. And skepticism is important to us, which is why we do a series of shows on them. So
I think we three in particular, and a lot of people in our kind of vein of skepticism, also are actually skeptical of things, even things that we find would very much fit our worldview. If it's too convenient, we even try and hold that up to a very rigorous.
Actually, rigorous if there standard. Is a theory that I'm, that's new to me and that I really like and that I really want to continue with, I tend to be a lot more skeptical because I know, or at least I try to be more skeptical because my interest and my emotions about it can cloud my judgment, and I do have to correct for that.
I just try because I hate to be publicly wrong ever, so I like to really research something before I throw it in there.
Yeah. I've been publicly wrong about things. I've made mistakes before, and that's I feel like that's the truest form of being a skeptic is to acknowledge that you're wrong and to change your opinion if you've been proven wrong.
Right. And this is Ask an Atheist, and we will be back in a minute. Welcome back to Ask an Atheist. If you'd like to talk to us, our phone number is 253-584-1480, and our topic for today is 30,000 feet of pseudoscience.
All right, and I'm live. So that's right. This is season 3, episode 3.
It is.
And we are here in Lakewood at KLOI Studios. So anyway, I want to touch on why critical thinking was important. So what is the harm in believing that something that has no proof? I'm going to throw it out to you guys. Any ideas as to if there's any harm in believing anything that's there's no proof?
Could you give a more specific example?
Sure. Let's say that let me give you some example. Okay, let's suppose I have some sort of remedy that has homeopathic ingredients, which is, and the manufacturer claims that these ingredients are that they're going to cure my headache, like head on, for example.
Oh yeah, and I only recently learned that this was a homeopathic.
Yes.
I thought it was just Asper cream in a funky shaped bottle.
Yeah, like chapstick for the brain.
Right.
I thought it was a very well financed practical joke on Americans, actually,
and America fell for it.
Well,
sadly,
it could very well be.
Yeah.
But it never occurred to me to buy it. I mean, I thought the commercials were kind of weird, and weird in a good way. And then I find out later that they're being sued out of existence because they, you know, it turns out the kind of medication you get in head on, you can get by wiping your head against any random wall.
Yes. Yeah. Sad but true. There's a lot to be said for the placebo effect, which is if you believe something will help you, there's a 25% to 30% chance that you actually feel your pain reduced. You know. The funny thing about the placebo effect, and a lot of products rely on – a lot of – actually, homeopathy relies on the placebo effect, is that there's no real organic healing. There's no limbs coming back. There's no vision being restored.
Right.
You know, your teeth aren't going to grow back into your mouth. It's always headaches and generalized pain.
Could you touch on the placebo effect a bit for folks who might not be familiar?
Oh, sure. In a nutshell, it is it's a known effect, whereas if a patient is given a medication, a sugar pill, and they're told that this medication will cure them of their headache or relieve some back pain or something to that effect, 25 to 30% of the population will feel the effects of the pain reduced.
Okay.
And so it says a lot about the ability of the mind to heal itself or to reduce pain.
And that's something they have to mathematically contend with whenever they do a drug trial involving the pain medication.
Exactly.
Okay. And so the question was, why would something like head-on possibly be a detriment to actually believe in it and use it? And if it is working for you to cure your headaches, but it's not working, you get the same effect with a chapstick to the forehead.
Exactly.
There could be something seriously wrong with your brain, and you're not even feeling enough pain anymore to go to the doctor and get it checked out. There could be something crawling around in there.
Yeah, and what about the ethics of charging somebody for a product that is no better than a sugar pill? Hmm? You know, what are the ethics behind that?
Well, it depends on if you're Ayn Rand or a Democrat, I suppose.
Wow. Okay. out there, political reference.
Okay. So anyway, there's a great website called whatstheharm.net, and it basically catalogs common the common beliefs that people have and things that don't exactly actually work, and actually shows the harm that's come from them. And I thought I'd drop that into
In defense of, I guess, lying in some level, there is always the the little white lie really is a psychological coping mechanism in some ways, is that sometimes we lie to ourselves just to get through the day or something. I don't really want to provide excuses for that.
Sure.
Because they're all going to bum me out.
Yeah.
But the difference there is we don't make national policy or choices about drugs or things like that based on these little white lies. And that's the difference for me is, again, when I'm doing just to get through the day and when I'm thinking about something skeptically and I'm trying to make a decision about what medication I'm going to take, what doctor I'm going to listen to, that's not the time to lie. That's the time when truth must rule.
Yeah. Well, that raises a good question is, which is more important, to believe a difficult lie or a soft fib?
Right.
Or, a difficult truth or a soft fib? And, you know, I guess that's something that we all have to figure out for ourselves.
Right.
Yeah. Moving on. The burden of proof.
Oh, I like this one.
What is it and who has it? I want to relate to you a story that is kind of relevant to this, and that is, a couple years ago, our skeptics group, I'm the organizer of Seattle Skeptics now over at Blue Star Cafe in the North End. That's where we meet every third Tuesday. Anyway, we came across, and I'm sure you folks have seen it, 9/11 is an inside job.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, these posters and people giving out flyers and DVDs. And they made the claim that 9/11 was perpetrated by someone on the inside. Years ago, they used to directly say the Bush administration. But that's since softened because it doesn't quite fit into their narrative with Obama now being president. But,
and what are you going to do if it was the Bush administration? Because they're gone now. They're out of power. I mean, I suppose you could push for a court show, but you're not going to make any positive change on the government by doing this because those people are gone.
Well,
and so their point has conveniently shifted.
Are the 9/11 truthers out for positive governmental change? Is that their
in their minds? I think they are.
Oh,
yeah.
I think they
also shifted from directly naming the Bush administration because it makes them a partisan group.
Right.
You know, that they're saying Republicans have perpetrated evil, and I think that they were trying to step out of that argument.
Okay.
And anyway, moving the story along. So they make the claim that 9/11 was an inside job. So I asked them to present their best evidence for why they thought 9/11 was an inside job, and when they actually presented their evidence, all of their evidence was attacking the official report. And I said, well, that's not proof of an inside job. That's proof that maybe the report is faulty or they made mistakes, but mistakes in that report don't indicate inside job.
Right.
And the basic assertion there is you have the burden of proof. Prove that their explosives were planted. Prove that that people were in on it. Get some confessions. Get some solid evidence in your favor. And they could never do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that says a lot about burden of proof. What do you guys have to say about that? Or burden of proof in general? Any thoughts about?
Well, generally, they're going to shift it, right? I mean, when you had that conversation and they're throwing all that at you, it is the end of game is going to be prove it didn't happen.
Right.
Prove that the Bush administration, a group known for being great at covering things up, by the way.
Yeah, which is true. Which is, I'll grant you that. Absolutely, the Bush administration is probably one of the least transparent presidencies that we had in a long time.
Very non-transparent, but also when they did try and cover up just, let's say, the vice president shooting a guy alone.
Oh, okay. Let's avoid that topic specifically. we do try to avoid the overt political topics.
Yeah, right? Okay. So actually what I really want to touch on was the whole question of burden of proof.
Mm.
And if you guys had ever come across anything like that where someone tried to shift the burden of proof onto you to disprove their belief or
right.
Have you guys ever ran into anything
well,
like that?
Well, that's a thing that happens a lot and is whenever you're given a claim that's strange, you know, like I was visited by aliens last night was something we've talked about.
Yeah.
And they say, well, you know, here's my proof and I've been visited by aliens, you guys should believe me. And I said, I don't believe you. He's like, well, you're making a claim that I wasn't visited by aliens. So the burden of proof is on you. And I'm like, wait a minute. The burden, I'm trying to prove that nothing happened. And in that scenario, nothing is really valid proof. The fact that I'm providing you with nothing to show that nothing happened is in its own way proof. As I'm sort of arguing for the status quo, so you have to bring something to me so that I have something to argue against. So even if the burden of proof is mine, you still have to provide evidence.
You know, and another red flag for claims that may be invalid is when someone attacks you for asking questions, for the very notion of you saying, we'll provide proof, and they say to you, well, you're not qualified to look at proof, or you haven't been there, you don't know what it's like, you have no experience in this field whatsoever, so I don't need to provide proof to you for my claim.
Right.
And that's a common tactic, is to attack the questioner.
Sure.
That you're closed-minded, or you don't understand science, or you don't understand what I'm talking about.
It happens a lot more than I think people would be willing to admit. I mean, a lot of talk news is occasionally is attacking the questioner in some ways when we're talking about subjects of science. So, and maybe we should talk about how what we see today in the world that where skepticism and pseudoscience sort of play.
Oh, again. Sure, sure. I think probably the best example we can start with, it would probably be the end of the world as we know it.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. For those of you who don't know, the Mayan calendar, which is, I don't know why it's suddenly important to everyone, but the Mayan calendar is apparently going to end, stop tracking days apparently on December 21st of 2012.
I believe that's true.
Yes. And so some say, some report that this is a sign of the end times. This is the end of the world as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
So the burden of proof is on those making the claim. Well, just because a calendar ends on a certain date, what evidence do you have that the world will end?
Well, if that were true, the world would end every year. Actually, the world would already be over because I've got a calendar from 2008 on my wall in the office. So did the world end in 2008 because my calendar ended?
Great point. Your claim would be just as valid as theirs is. Just because a calendar ended, it doesn't mean the end of the world as we know it.
Right.
Yeah. So I don't know if you guys have heard of the show Decoded by Brian Meltzer. He's a Dan Brown-esque author, and they did a show on the end of the world as we know it, 2012 ending. And so they referenced the Mayan calendar, but they also brought up the Hopi Indians. Apparently, the Hopi Indians have passed down an oral tradition where they make prophecies.
Yeah.
The problem with this, as we're watching the show, we look at it. The problem is that all the things they pass down are oral tradition. Nothing is written down. Well, how do we know that the person telling us that the Hopis predicted cars, the internet, radio, how do we know that any of these things are true with no real way of proving it whatsoever?
Right, yeah. Right. And one of our favorite sort of end-of-the-world predictions is something that we go along about on the radio is our countdown to backpedaling.
I know where you're going, yeah.
Yeah, I believe it is 118 days until the end of the world.
Yes.
And this is their world is – or no, it's 117 days till the end of the world. But we're counting 118 days because we're counting to when the backpedaling begins.
Again. Right. So those of you who haven't maybe tuned in before, what we're referring to is the We Can Know website. That,
right.
Where is the group located? Are they're in the Midwest somewhere?
Somewhere in the Midwest,
okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, they claim that Revelations, that the end of days is going to occur starting May 21st of this year. And so what we've done is we've actually come up with a counter website, We Can't Know.
Right.
With a countdown clock and everything. Brilliant stuff. And I can't wait to see and as you said, I can't wait for the countdown to backpedaling.
Right.
Because when May 22nd happens and we're going to have a big party, either that or we'll have a lot of pets that need to be taken care of.
Yeah. Either that or we'll be busy.
A lot of real estate will be freed up. Either way, it's going to be a big party for us atheists.
Again, this is Ask an Atheist. You can give us a call at 253-584-1480. And we're talking about skepticism.
Yes, we are. So anyway, there's some websites that are actually trying to monetize this whole end of days thing. And they've got post-rapture pet care kind of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think is a great idea. That's a great idea.
Has anyone ever predicted the end of the world in a way that hasn't made someone an enormous amount of money? If anyone's been into a bookstore lately and noticed the number of 2012 books?
Let's see. The only end of the world prediction I can think of that didn't make someone a lot of money, probably the only one that comes off the top of my head, would probably be Heaven's Gate.
Heaven's Gate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they actually made their money from web development, strangely enough.
Yeah. And actually, they were apparently pretty good at it.
Yeah, they were known in the industry. Having once been in that industry myself, I actually was aware of them before it occurred. And then to find out that company was actually a cult in disguise was a bit of a surprise.
Oh, yeah, so they did somehow monetize it.
Well, yeah, it was a bunch of people in a room in California in the 90s. What are you going to do? Internet startup.
Yeah. And for those of you who don't know the story, Heaven's Gate was a UFO cult that claimed that when Halley's Comet got close enough that they'd be able to be transported to the mothership. And so what they did was on their final day when apparently Halley's Comet was close enough.
It was a Hale-Bopp comet, was it not?
It probably was. Yeah, I apologize. It was probably Hale-Bopp. Thank you. They drank the Kool-Aid quite literally, and they all perished. So,
they did.
Yeah. So what's the harm in believing things that are kind of fanciful? Well, there you go.
That is a pretty extreme example.
Sudden and terminal death, yes.
An example it is.
Yes.
Well, going back to burden of proof, I guess you cannot actually prove that their souls did not somehow ride that comet somewhere.
Proving a negative is always
unlikely.
Difficult. Yes, proving a negative is always difficult. We'd have to start with the assertion that souls exist.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have to prove that the UFOs exist. I mean, that they were in the Hale-Bopp comet. There's a lot of things that they'd have to prove. And just feeling that it's true is not good enough. And we see where that leads.
So if I was arguing against you at this point, though, if I was actually playing devil's advocate, I would say, since you don't believe that souls exist and you don't believe that Nikes and poison and a comet can get you to heaven, I'd say you're being closed-minded.
Well, you know, reality is one of those things that continues to exist whether I believe in it or not. You know, so whether or not I believe in souls is irrelevant. Can souls be proven? That's the fair thing. It shouldn't be one of those things that requires my faith or belief. It should be one of those things that exists and is provable.
Once again, I have to say the evidence. Show me the evidence. The burden of proof is on the people who are trying to tell me that the souls were on a comet or anything else. For example, this new astrological sign. Is that the burden of proof is on the people who are making the claims.
Right.
And you have to provide me evidence, and if you provide me with good evidence and the proof is there, then okay, I'm going to have to change my mind.
Right.
And I would say I am not closed-minded because if you provide me with that evidence, I will change my mind. I have changed my mind on things in the past, and I will do so again in the future. And again, this is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480.
So astrology, we touch on a very interesting topic there, and it makes it asserts that the gravitational pull of the moon and celestial forces, and I would throw in some electromagnetic energy, that has play on what our personalities are going to be when we're born, and also has play on what our lives are going to be like in our day to day existence. You know, like, this is a good time to make decisions, or now's a good time to date, or you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
So that's a very, very basic premise that can be tested. Are people who are born in May more stubborn than other people, or are Virgo smarter than Aries? I mean, those are testable things.
Well, and that was a big thing in the news recently. Is that apparently all of the astrological signs have shifted, and now there's a new one, like that Chattahoochee or whatever it is.
Ophiuchus
or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a man handling a snake, right?
Yeah,
something like that.
It's
yeah,
Pentecostal.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay. But does that mean anybody – and I know there's a cutoff date for when that sign took place, but if you were born before or after that time, does your personality suddenly shift now that everybody's signs have shifted one step to the left?
Well, I saw an article recently, and astrologers have assured everyone that whatever sign you were born under, you're still that sign. I don't know if there's agreement if it affects people now, but when you don't use science, when you're just using your gut to determine – what reality
that
is.
That was a weird thing, is that somehow gravitational forces or whatever in the stars can affect how you are only when you're born, not during conception, not during the most critical phases of neurological development, but only when you were born, the exact instant. And after that, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. This reminds me of a test that was done not long ago, a couple decades ago, where they had those charts that tell you what personalities are what. Like, let's suppose Aries has a strong sense of justice.
Right.
So anyway, what they did was they took all the astrological signs and they mixed up each sign with its description of what it is. And what they did was they had people read through all the descriptions and choose which one best fits them. And every case, they got no better than chance in terms of whether or not their sign matched their personality. And that really tells us a lot about whether or not there's any real science behind astrology.
We actually did a little bit of experiment like that when I was a kid. We got a copy of Carl Sagan's Demon Haunted World.
Beautiful.
Where in it he's got sort of the quintessential horoscope. And we read it out loud, and our friends who were, you know, good friends, but a little weird about the astrology, we started reading it, and everybody's like, yep, that's me, without even telling them what sign it was. It's like we didn't do a double-blind study. We didn't try and get one over on them. We were just reading it out loud, and they were totally buying into it until we showed them what book we were reading and what it was.
If you take a vague description and you have the entirety of your life to data mine the hits of that description to it, you will think that you are that sign. My favorite one is someone with a strong sense of justice. If you think about that, you can apply that to so many areas of your life. You get angry when somebody cuts you off, or you're upset when you see criminals and you want to see them get the chair or something like that. It's one of those things where you have your whole life to data mine it, and you will apply it to your life.
Absolutely. And this is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. We'll be back after this. Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. And before we pick up our topic again, I'd like to mention that this week, as like we do every other week, we meet up somewhere in Tacoma. All of us, the people who work on the show, have some dinner, have a couple drinks, and discuss stuff. And if you would like to join us in that, we will be at Doyle's Public House at 208 St. Helens in Tacoma. and we'll be there at about 5 p.m.
Okay, so let's touch a little bit on logical fallacies. And this is something that skeptics see often, and that is when someone defends their particular hypothesis or they attack someone else, these are tools that are used in an argument that aren't logical. And one of my favorites, the first one that we're going to touch on, is ad hominem. This is an attempt to counter another's claims or conclusions by attacking the person rather than addressing the argument itself. True believers will often commit this fallacy by countering the arguments of skeptics by stating that skeptics are closed-minded. Skeptics, on the other hand, may fall into the trap of dismissing the claims of UFO believers by stating that people who believe in UFOs are crazy or stupid. And that blurb comes courtesy of Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. They are a fantastic podcast, and we'll touch on them later. But what do you guys think about it? Have you come across ad hominem attacks? Or
every day of my life.
Okay.
I mean...
This is a list of logical fallacies, but that could also be just something you should avoid in a relationship argument. Also,
an ad
hominem attack.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a good start.
Got off topic there, but
yeah. No,
there's a PSA right there.
Yeah.
Don't insult people. Ding 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 ding.
Yeah. So,
next though, or
yeah, let's touch on a few. I've got a bunch of logical fallacies here. Another one. This is one of my favorites, and I actually come across this quite a bit. This is argument from ignorance, and this states that a specific belief is true because we don't know it isn't true. Defenders of extrasensory perception, for example, will often overemphasize how much we do not know is about the human brain. UFO proponents will often argue that an object sighted in the sky is unknown, and therefore it is an alien spacecraft.
Right.
And, you know, argument for ignorance is probably the favorite logical fallacy of ghost hunters. You know, there's a cold spot here, therefore ghost. There's a sound here that we cannot explain, therefore ghost.
Right.
You know, anytime you see an orb in a picture, you see they get a spike on one of their EMF detectors, it's got to be a ghost.
Right. And yeah. Actually, argument from ignorance is probably the logical fallacy that atheism is most often accused of.
Oh, yeah.
Is what we're saying is – and this is, again, this goes back to something we've touched on every radio show so far – is that we are agnostic atheists. From a knowledge standpoint, we are agnostics. From an action standpoint, from a belief standpoint, we are atheists. We are honest about the evidence. There is no evidence for or against of God, for or against a god or gods. We are honest about that. We choose to act in a way and believe in a way that there is no god. That we act in a skeptical way.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
That is not an argument from ignorance.
Right. Right.
It's a statement of ignorance in some way.
Right. If somehow, you know, God appeared, opened up the skies, the clouds, you know, and he came down and said all these things are true, and you know, I could verify that Noah's Ark existed, and he shows us proof of all these things. It's one of those things where
it'd take more than that, because if somebody just appeared down from on the sky, you know, okay, spaceship. I'm having a psychotic break. I mean,
well, this is an interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting question. Is how would someone convince you, if it was God, how would they convince the three of us in this room? It would take something different for every single one of us.
Yeah.
And Jerry, who's here today helping out, is got the best answer of that. He goes, you know what? If it's God, he'll know the answer to that question.
That is a great answer, yeah. And that's something we talk about a lot. It's something that it gets kicked around at the meetups a lot. Is that what would take it to convince you? Because that's a question we get a lot. Like when we sit booths at street fairs and, you know, Seattle Atheists or Tacoma Atheists or whatever group I'm participating with, we'll get, what would it take to convince you? You are completely non-convincible. And I talked about this last week, is that I'll get that at bars if I'm known as an atheist. You know, what would it – you won't buy any evidence that there's no God. It would take some serious evidence.
It would take God. God would have to do it.
Right.
And if I'm non-convincible, then you're not giving your God a lot of credit there.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, this – I got a great topic for you guys that falls in the sweet spot of both skepticism and atheism. Have you guys heard about this minister over in Florida who calls himself Jesus Christ, the Second Coming?
No,
he purports to be that. He was on the show Religious, but he claims that he is the second coming of Christ. And he actually has a fairly large following.
He's a Hispanic gentleman?
Yes, he is. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I thought he was in Argentina.
I thought he was somewhere in South America. But Florida, I believe 100%. I do not need to verify that in any way, shape, or form. I do believe
that he's in Florida?
Yeah, okay. I believe that.
But anyway, a great question is, how do we prove or disprove, well, how do we prove, I should say, that he's Jesus Christ? How do you prove that? You know? And so far as all he does is say he's Jesus Christ, and that's about it. But the believers, who I'm convinced have an emotional response. They've bypassed all the need for evidence. There's an emotional response inside them that tells them, I feel it, therefore it's real. And that is the very antithesis of skepticism. That is,
right.
My gut is telling me this is real, and I'm going 100% pedal to the metal on it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so,
a lot of people, that is the threshold of truth they're looking for.
Yes. Yes.
And they're very difficult to convince of anything else. If they decide that's what it is and they feel it, it's something you almost can't argue with, or it often could get very dangerous to argue with.
Yes.
Well, this is something that they know in marketing and advertising. This is something that they know in the preaching trade, is facts do not convince. Emotions convince.
Yes.
And these are people looking for an emotional argument.
Right, right. I think that's one of the challenges of the skeptical and scientific community, is to find an argument that is both factual and appeals to the emotions.
Right.
You know? And that's one of my challenges as organizers, to find that argument.
The most emotional things I've heard are sort of the majesty of understanding that comes when you hit a certain area in physics or mathematics. And that's really hard to translate into mass media, because that means we'd have to teach everybody math and physics to a point where they could feel that way.
I'm convinced that certain people receive stimuli in different ways.
Yeah.
You know, that some of us are more left brain thinking, and therefore reading and math and logic and science are really stimulating and exciting things. And for other people, emotion and praying and raising their arms and, you know, singing in a chorus, in a choir, that does it for them and nothing else.
Don't knock singing.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm
joking. Well, your next one on the list here is one of my favorites,
okay.
And I really want to get to that, and that's Argument from Authority.
Do you want to read it or shall I?
No, okay. Go right ahead.
Argument from Authority. This is a nice one. This is a logical fallacy that states that a claim is true because a person or group of perceived authority says it's true. Often this argument is implied by emphasizing the many years of experience or the formal degrees held by the individual making the specific claim. It is education and credentials or to be suspicious of the claims of someone making authoritative statements in an area for which they cannot demonstrate expertise. But the truth of the claim should ultimately rest on logic and evidence, not the authority of the person promoting it.
Right.
What are your thoughts around that?
Well, if people didn't fall for that one, there'd be whole areas of advertising that would just fall dead. The celebrity endorsement. The celebrity endorsement, which is so much of advertising these days, would just completely disappear, because that's sort of a weird argument from authority. I'm famous, I use this product, therefore buy this product. And then there's also one of our favorite bugbears is the creationism, intelligent design, teach the controversy people, where almost all of the arguments I've seen that aren't bad science are arguments from authority. Like, this is also true in people who, and global warming deniers, where here is a list of 5,000 scientists, they don't tell you what kind of scientists, that do not believe in climate change or do not believe in evolution. And then you look at the list of scientists, and they're not, you know, in the case of evolution, they're not geneticists, they're not biologists, they're not people involved in evolutionary study or study of life, but they're geophysicists or meteorologists or things like that. And so they may well be scientists. They may be published. They might be peer-reviewed, but they're not subject matter experts on evolution. And at that point, it becomes nothing but an argument from authority.
You make a great point. I don't know if you know, but there's a huge rift between climatologists and meteorologists.
Right.
And you know the difference between the two. The meteorologist is looking at weather patterns for the upcoming week, whereas the climatologist is looking at patterns for decades. And those two camps do not agree for the most part. There was actually a great news report on ABC World News tonight where they talked about how most meteorologists don't believe in climate change,
mm-hmm.
Whereas almost all climatologists do. And so there's actually one meteorologist. That's
actually still even with that divide. That's really surprising to me.
Yes, it is. So one meteorologist, he was set out to prove whether or not this was true. And he went up He met with climatologists. He actually went to the North Pole and he saw the shrinking ice caps for himself, and he changed his mind. And now he's setting out to change the minds of other meteorologists by having special classes, by meeting with them. And so he's being a real advocate for the fact that climate change exists.
All right.
So,
well, this is Ask an Atheist. And if you'd like to talk to us, our phone number is 253-584-1480. And if you're not interested in talking to us but like to leave us a message, you can go to our website at www.askanatheist.tv and click the big red button, and you'll be brought to a form, and you can contact us there. Also, a podcast of this show plus our previous television shows, there it's all on the website.
So let's touch on Argument from Final Consequence. This is a fun one. So Argument from Final Consequence is it's based on the reversal of cause and effect. Because they argue that something is caused by the ultimate effect that it has or the purpose it serves. For example, God must exist otherwise, because otherwise life would have no meaning.
Right.
Yes.
That argument makes me so angry sometimes. I am somehow incapable of assigning meaning to my own life.
Right.
My meaning must be given to me from somebody I have never seen, never met, and we'll never have proof of.
You could argue that the other way. You could go, if God just made me on a whim, I have absolutely no meaning.
You could
easily argue that that sentence is just a figure eight Mobius strip of bad logic.
Yes,
it's five-dimensional also.
Right.
I once gave a talk at Cascadia Community College, and one of the students there, he asked me, well, if God didn't create us, then what is our purpose in life? I said, you know, if you don't believe in God, you should look at that as empowerment. You figure out what you want to do in life.
Mm-hmm. It's not really an answer, but I always say go find one.
Go find, yeah.
Yeah.
Who says that you have to be assigned a purpose? Go make your own purpose. There's nothing wrong with that at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Hardly a scientific argument, but that really is an appeal to emotion, and I've never lied about what that is.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the difference, is when I do make an appeal to an emotion, I'll tell you. I won't lie about it.
You know, I want to touch on one of the inadvertent side effects of skepticism and atheism, and that is, I don't know if this has occurred with you guys, but you see a movie that, like The Exorcist, there's one coming out soon, The Rite, with Anthony Hopkins. It's an Exorcist-type movie, and it's filled with, you know, spinning heads and, you know, bodies rising off of beds and that sort of thing. And as an atheist skeptic, it doesn't affect me in the slightest. I don't find it scary in the slightest. As a kid, that kind of movie would scare the heck out of me. But how about you guys? I mean, does it roll over into how you perceive movies?
Specifically with the Exorcist vein of movies, which there's been a lot of in a while, because they're done in sort of this Blair Witch style where they're claiming it to be true, and it's something I patently do not believe in. I've done a lot of research on this sort of thing, looked into I can't suspend my disbelief at all for something like that. But for a different movie, science fiction or something like that wants to be a horror film and deal with supernatural stuff, since I know it's... Is that weird? That since I know absolutely a lie,
yeah.
It's easy, actually, to suspend my
disbelief.
That's
internally...
But when they're trying to convince me of some institution's power to move demons around that exist in the real world, I can't do it.
I think your logic is internally consistent.
Yeah.
Because if they say, based upon a true story, the first thing I want to know is, what's the story? Mm-hmm. Anthony Hopkins, in the trailer for that movie, says, you skeptics are always looking for evidence. What are you going to do when you find it? Almost like a Jesse Ventura kind of thing. And I'm like, show me the evidence. I want to see it. I'm not afraid of it.
Document
you know?
It?
Yeah.
Publish?
Yeah.
Make a ton of money?
Take pictures of it?
Yeah. There's this whole notion that science does not want to see ghosts proven right or psychic powers to be proven right because they have some sort of emotional investment in the opposite being true, but it's not true.
Well, it's kind of true for the same reasons that people are willing to use other means to promulgate these ideas. Is that if somebody comes up with a good scientific theory of a previously disproven phenomenon, some careers are going to be made, some careers are going to be ended. It's going to be a real game changer.
Yes, and it'll be commercially exploited.
Absolutely.
If psychic powers could be proven and harvested and trained and
if we could prove psychic powers, we could probably put a lot of supposed psychics out of business.
Absolutely.
Like that,
yes, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Have some sort of standardized test based upon what they say their claim is. I really think that...
And I'll tell you, the price of a psychic would go way up.
Yeah.
If you'd have a certified psychic.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I do think that psychics should have certification. You know, if somebody can set up shop and say that I will claim your future, get rid of that whole disclaimer at the bottom for entertainment purposes only. That's total bullshit, bogus nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And certify them. You know, have them licensed and certified.
In a way, James Randi's search for a psychic and the $1 million check is sort of an anti-certification. Is that, it's sort of a process you go to become uncertified as a psychic, unproven as a psychic.
Yes.
And that only one person can win that, but they have to come with real proof, real provable stuff.
For those of you who don't know, the James Reading Educational Foundation has come up with a $1 million challenge for anyone who claims that they have psychic abilities, any ability that has been proven by science already.
It's basically any supernatural power.
Yeah,
right?
Fly, teleport, telekinesis, anything.
That was water.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And so what he did was he threw up $1 million and said, if you can prove it under controlled circumstances, controlled conditions rather, I will give you $1 million. The challenge has been going on for a few decades now. No one has taken the prize.
Right.
So, of course, you know, looking at argument from the ad hominem, they'll attack James Randi and say, well, he's not giving up that money because he doesn't want to give it up. It's his own money. And that's not true.
That's not his money. Isn't it all donations and things like that?
Maybe it's his pride. I'm not sure what argument they're going to make. But they generally attack James Randi and the foundation for always making the test too hard to pass or something to that effect. And
well, we
that's
are
not true.
Running into the end of the hour. So.
Oh, yeah. That flew by.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is there anything you'd like to close with on the subject of?
Well, I would like to be able to touch on skeptical groups and resources before we close out. There's some really good ones. If you enjoy this topic, I highly recommend you check out the James Randi Educational Foundation, which is something that I really had relied on very heavily in my early days as a skeptic. Randi.org. It's a fantastic organization. If you're more the reader, check out James Randi's Flim Flam book, Carl Sagan's Demon Haunted World. Maybe check out even the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast. It is fantastic. Or if you're more of a social set, we have the Seattle Skeptics meetup group. Just Google Seattle Skeptics.
Which is you, and I've been there, and it's a great time.
Thank you very much.
We had some great people.
We had Jen McCrate give us a talk on her tour of the Creation Museum, and that was a lot of fun. We had a packed house last Tuesday. So
very
always
cool.
A good time. Yes.
Like I said, skepticism and pseudoscience is a topic we'll be talking about a lot on Ask an Atheist, and thank you very much, Case, for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
And thank you very much, Jeremy, for your first time in front of the microphone.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Not the last.
Yes.
Again, Ask an Atheist is a production of NEDM Media and recorded live at KLAY Studios in Lakewood, Washington. Our digital director was Mike Gillis, our call screener was Scott Leopold, and our auxiliary was Jerry Schiffelbein. You can catch us online at www.askanatheist.tv.
Or catch us live at Doyle's.
Or catch us live at Doyle's in about an hour. All right, thanks, guys.
Thank you, everyone.